we're going to get started in a couple minutes. Just to mention a couple things you may remember from last time. If you're sitting in a chair, we're going to do some really basic meditation, so you might find it more comfortable to have a cushion if your feet don't reach all the way to the floor. Having a cushion to rest your feet on helps you when we're doing these basic meditations, if you need that. Please turn off or mute your cell phones if you have them with you, or as we say here, put them on meditate. And like I said, we'll get started in a couple minutes. So welcome, everyone, or welcome back. This is Buddhism in a Nutshell, session number 2. April 2nd. So is there anybody here who was not here last week? Anybody the very first time? Okay, a few people. Great. For those of you who weren't here last week, in the very back corner, as you're leaving, you don't have to go and get one of these now, but we have some little handouts there, little one-page handouts. And those review some of the information that I went over last week, just about Kadampa Center, who we are, the organization we belong to, a little bit about our resident teacher. So feel free to grab one of those on your way out. Anyone else who wants one, what I'm going to ask, I didn't have as many with me as I thought I might, so anybody else who wants one, maybe just for this week, if you'd leave those for the people who are just brand new and weren't here last week, and then when I have a chance, or next week, I'll bring some more, I'll make some copies and bring some more. Oh, the handouts, the review from the first week that I have on the, you're on it. Sandy's on it. Okay, so, yeah, they're on the table right behind there. So Sandy, being wonderful as she always is going to make more copies. That way, anybody who wants one can grab one. And for those of you who weren't here last week, welcome. Welcome to Kadampa Center. For those who weren't here last week, how many people is this your very, very first time at Kadampa Center? For anybody who wasn't here last week. Okay, a couple. All right, great. Well, you picked a good time to come. This course is basically intended to, for a large part, it's intended for people who are totally new to Buddhism, who just want a basic introduction and overview to Buddhist philosophy and practices. So my name is Scott Miller, and I'm going to be leading the class. We meet for 5 weeks. This is the second week. And just to kind of do a little bit of review, or a little bit about what we're going to do today, we're going to do a brief review, talk a little bit, not in a lot of detail, but a little bit about what we discussed last week, just to get everybody's mind back in that mode. We're going to have a more detailed discussion of the role of the mind in Tibetan Buddhism, and we're going to talk in a little more detail about the Four Noble Truths, which is, we talked about that a little bit last week. It was the first teaching that the Buddha gave and kind of forms the core for Buddhist teachings. So we're going to start out with a meditation, and meditation is also one of the topics we're going to discuss in the course. So it's kind of helpful to do one right at the beginning of the class just as a chance to settle your mind a little bit. So go ahead and do that. Just take a moment as we get started to settle your mind. Set aside all the busyness of the day, anything that was going on before you got here, anything that you have to do later. And we always start off by setting in a motivation, an intention, an altruistic motivation for being here. So think about what brought you here this evening. And there are a lot of other things that you could be doing right now, but you all chose to be here. And think about how being here might benefit you. Just learning some new things, if you don't really know that much about Buddhism. Learning about a new topic. Learning more or reviewing, if you already know a bit about Buddhism. This could be a nice review. So think about how being here might help you not just benefit yourself, but also how that might be of benefit to others. Even meditation, just taking a few moments to quiet your mind, can be a tremendous benefit. And just to review the meditation posture we talked about last week, if you're sitting in a chair or on a cushion, which really the important thing is whichever is more comfortable for you, If you are sitting in a chair, try not to be leaning back, but have your back away from the back of the chair a little bit, sitting up straight. Both feet down flat on the ground or on a cushion. If you're sitting on a cushion, then just sit in whatever posture, just comfortable cross-legged posture, whatever's comfortable for you. And in this, you can have your hands resting on your knees if that works for you. Or in this tradition, normally we have our palms facing up, right hand resting on the left hand, and thumbs just gently touching in the middle. And just rest your palm, your hands in your lap. Have your arms away from your body a little bit. Let a little air circulate. Important thing is to have your back straight, supporting your body, kind of like a stack of coins. Jaw and mouth relaxed, tongue resting on the roof of your mouth just behind your upper teeth. Your head just tilted slightly forward to direct your gaze naturally towards the ground a few feet in front of you. Your eyes either closed or just slightly open enough to let in a little light. Shoulders back slightly, not rigid, but back a little bit to open up your chest. So focus your attention on your breathing and breathe naturally. Become present in the moment and place where you are. Just focus the mind on the rising and falling of your shoulders and chest as you inhale and exhale gently. Allow your mind to settle and become calm and present, ready to engage in meditation. And in this meditation, you're going to focus your attention on your physical body. Start by focusing your attention on the lowermost point of your body, where your body is in contact with the earth. Feel the substance and earthy character of your body. Concentrate for a moment on that contact, on the weight and substance of this physical form. Pay attention to the character of your mind, your consciousness, while focusing there. Paying attention that lowermost point of your body in contact with the earth. And taking a moment to observe your mind as you focus there. Now slowly and mindfully move your attention upward through your body. Pay close attention to every aspect of your body, your physical sensations. Note areas of tension and relax them. Note sensations of coolness or warmth. Note places where one part of your body is touching another. Slowly and mindfully move upward through your legs, your hips, your hands in your lap or on your knees. Note the curves of your body's silhouette. Move upward through your belly, your waist, and the curves of your arms. Continue to move upward and note the rising and falling of your chest with your breathing. Note the curves of your shoulders. Keep moving upward, slowly and mindfully. Pay special attention to your shoulders, neck, and jaw. If there is any tension there, relax those areas. Keep moving upward through the tilt of your head until you reach the crown of your head. You're going to rest your attention at the crown of your head for a moment. Pay attention to the character of your mind, your consciousness, while you're focusing there. Is your mind's character different while concentrating here than it was when you were focusing on the lowermost point of your body? And if so, what differences do you note? Slowly move your attention back downward through your body in the same way. Move slowly, mindfully, noting everything about your body as you move your attention back downward. Bring your attention all the way back down to the cushion or floor where your body is in contact with the earth. Again, focus your concentration at this point and note the character of your consciousness when focusing there. Again, note the nature of your mind state when concentrating here, and any differences from your mind state when concentrating at your crown. Finally, dedicate your positive energy and insights to the well-being and happiness of all living beings. Take a moment to remind yourself of your intention. Intention and the motivation are, we kind of look at those as bookends on the activities that we do. It's dedicating the energy to your well-being and the well-being of all other beings. So for anybody who wasn't here last week, we have this microphone that we pass around that some people don't mind. Some people feel a little weird using a microphone. Part of the reason is so that if you're on one side of the room, the people on the other side of the room can hear you over the train. But another reason is because we do record these, and we don't put them out like on YouTube for everybody who wants to go listen to them or see them. But for people who might have missed one class, they can come here to our computer here at Kadampa Center and get a copy of the recording. And if they're listening to it at home and someone asks a question, you really can't hear unless you use the mic. So this is tremendously helpful for those couple of reasons. So we're just going to pass this around when we talk, when we have discussions. So what did you all think about that meditation? Does anybody have any observations or comments or questions? Anything they want to share about it? Did anybody notice any differences when we talked about concentrating or noting the character of your mind when you're focusing on the lower part of your body? Was it any different? Was it different? You want to share some comments?
Sure.
You just volunteered.
Not really.
What differences did you notice?
When I was concentrating on where my body was in contact with the earth, I felt more strength.
Okay.
Whereas when I was concentrating on my crown, I felt more power, if that makes any sense.
Okay. Interesting. I haven't heard anybody describe it that way before, but that's great. Does anybody find anything similar or different?
Yeah, I was noticing that when I was focused on my feet, my mind didn't wander as much because I could feel the physical pressure
mm-hmm.
of my feet on the floor. But on my head, everything, it was just kind of, my thoughts were just kind of swirling around.
Okay.
So
more grounded on your feet?
Yeah.
Okay. And is that kind of what you were describing when you said strength versus power? Maybe a little more grounded energy in the strength and a little more kind of open energy in the power? Is that kind of what you felt? Or?
I'm going to come sit beside you.
Mm-hmm.
No, not really.
Okay.
Definitely the groundedness in my feet, for sure. I definitely felt like I almost was getting energy or gaining
mm-hmm.
strength, I guess, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was focusing on my crown, I almost kind of felt like this buzzy feeling at the top of my head.
Okay.
If that makes any sense.
Sure. No, it's great. Yeah, everybody's experience is a little different, right? I mean, you're meditating, it's your mind and your body, and people describe things different ways, people feel things different ways. So it's just interesting. You know, this is definitely the no right or wrong answer to this one. It's just kind of talking about what people observed and thinking about your experiences and what other people observed. Anybody else have anything they want to share? Yeah.
Similar. I think I felt more grounded at my feet, and I was trying to sort of figure out how to, it was difficult to express in words, but it came to me as sort of color. It felt more brown and sort of grounded here, and more sort of yellow and ethereal kind of spacey up here.
Okay, great. So color is associated with the feelings. That's perfect. That's great. Yeah, thanks. Anybody else?
Yeah.
My experience was kind of like his, where when I'm looking at concentrating on the ground, it feels, I just want to say dark.
Okay.
And then I don't know if it's because I'm maybe opening my eyes more as I work my way up, but then it just seems lighter up top.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, darker and lighter. Yep. It's similar. I mean, just my own experience is feeling, it's kind of similar to what some people are saying, a little more grounded when I'm focusing on the lower part of my body, and just a little more open and airy and lighter, you know, just a lighter feeling of mind up at the top. So, yeah, kind of along those lines. Anybody else? Okay. So we'll try to do at least one meditation each class and see if we can even try to get in two, if we can. Any questions that came up after the first class or during the week, kind of before we move on, any burning questions anybody has relating to what we talked about, specifically relating to what we talked about last week? Okay. So like I said, we began last week with a basic introduction to Kadampa Center and to this course. We have a handout, which Sandy very, very nicely made copies of, so anybody can grab one of those. You don't really need one now, but if you want on your way out, you're more than welcome to grab one. Last week we talked about Shakyamuni Buddha and who he is. So he lived in India about 2,500 years ago. He was a prince, the son of a king who ruled one of the number of kingdoms that India was divided into at that time. Had a very comfortable life, a very sheltered life growing up, and eventually became curious about the outside world. Went out and saw basically how other people lived and saw all the suffering that people experienced. Was very, very moved by that. And also became aware of these mendicants, these monks, wandering holy men who were wandering around India at the time, seeking the truth. So these holy men were seeking the truth about a lot of things, but about suffering particularly, about, you know, the causes of suffering and whether it was possible to end all this suffering that people experienced. So the prince became very, very curious about this, and he became a monk himself. He left behind his life, his comfortable life as a prince, and studied under different teachers, spent years and years and years in meditation, and finally we say that he became a Buddha and reached enlightenment. So that's the term Buddha means enlightened one. And does anybody remember when we say that he reached enlightenment and became a Buddha? There's a really specific definition of that. The definition of enlightenment and the word Buddha, the Sanskrit word Buddha, or Tibetan word Sangye, they're kind of related or similar definitions. Does anybody remember what the meaning of enlightenment? We have to worry about the mic for a second. I'll just repeat it if anybody remembers. So there's two specific characteristics we talked about of enlightenment. Does anybody remember either of them?
Truth.
Okay, you're on the right track, yeah. Anything else coming to mind? Okay. We haven't quite gotten into that, but that would be a characteristic of it, yeah.
Oh, yeah, no more uncontrolled
reason. Okay, yeah, we did talk a little bit about that. Yeah, somebody had a question about it. Yes, sir.
Like all-knowing,
yeah. So what a lot of these things are getting at is enlightenment, one characteristic of it is removing all non-virtuous states of mind. And fully developing all virtuous states of mind. So, what are some examples? We had some really good examples last week of virtuous states of mind. Does anybody remember some virtuous states of mind? What some of the examples we had were?
Kindness.
Yep, that would be a virtuous state of mind.
Compassion.
Yep. Generosity. So kind of all the things we would think of off the top of our heads as being virtuous. And what we say is a Buddha is someone who has fully developed all these virtuous states of mind and completely removed all non-virtuous states of mind. So any states of mind that would prevent you from knowing. So we do say that we talk about the Buddha's being all-knowing, knowing the truth, and these are basically the characteristics of being a Buddha. So when we talk about Shakyamuni Buddha, he is the historical Buddha who founded this tradition of, or this spiritual practice that we call Buddhism. So another thing we said about, and this might be a stretch for anybody to remember, but we said there's one central thing. I said Buddhism is all about one thing. Does anybody remember what that is? The mind. Yep, exactly. First, last, everything in between. Buddhism is about the mind. I'm going to write that up there because it's an important concept to remember. What's that? Complete control of mental states. That would be something to aspire to rather than letting them control us. But Buddhism is about the mind. Everything we do here, all the practices, the meditation, the prayers, all the wonderful art and statues that you see, everything is geared towards improving your mind and reaching the full potential of the mind. So we say the Buddha is not a creator. The Buddha didn't create enlightenment. He didn't create the world. He didn't create us. The Buddha is just someone who discovered certain truths. We said truth. Somebody said truths earlier. The Buddha is someone who discovered certain truths about the way things exist and about what our minds are capable of. And he basically achieved those truths or achieved those things himself and then spent the rest of his life teaching about them or sharing what he found out with us. And in this tradition, in the Mahayana tradition of Buddhism, which the Tibetan schools belong to, we believe that everyone is capable of achieving Buddhahood, that it's actually in the very nature of the mind to be able to achieve this, fully developing all positive states of mind, fully eliminating all non-virtuous states of mind. So that's just kind of a review from last week, some of the basic things we talked about. Any questions, comments, anything come up? Yeah. What is the mind? That is an awesome question. And that is a perfect segue into tonight's discussion. What we're going to talk about tonight, a couple things. One is I'm going to go over a little bit of the history of Buddhism first, and then we're going to talk specifically about the Buddhist view of the mind and what it is. And it's a very interesting topic because Buddhism has some very... some people would refer to Buddhism as the study of the mind. Because there are some very specific definitions and explanations about what the mind is that are part of this tradition. So we're going to get to that in a little more detail in just a couple minutes. So first, we want to talk a little bit about the history of Buddhism. After reaching enlightenment, as I mentioned a moment ago, Shakyamuni Buddha continued to teach. He was about 40 years old, we say, when he reached enlightenment through this very concentrated effort, this huge, tremendous effort.
Yeah.
32? Okay, yeah, about 40, 32 years exactly. Okay. So through a great, tremendous, concentrated effort, not just, you know, kind of snapped his fingers or read a book, but tremendous concentrated effort, he achieved this state of enlightenment and then continued to teach for about another 40 years. And it's said that he gave 84,000 different teachings. We talk sometimes about the three turnings of the wheel of Dharma. And does anybody remember what Dharma means, that term means? Anybody, did we talk about that a little bit last week? Teachings, yeah, that's the way we usually use it to refer to the teachings of the Buddha. The word, actually, it's a Sanskrit word that means literally means that which holds or protects. So we talk about different types of Dharma, like the more common way we use it is to refer to the teachings of the Buddha. But we talk about conventional Dharma, which are those teachings, and then we can also talk about ultimate Dharma or absolute Dharma, which is actual realizations in the minds of enlightened beings. So the actual experiences or realizations that come from understanding those teachings. So each turn, we say that there were three turnings of the wheel of Dharma, and each turning of the wheel of Dharma refers to a specific set of teachings that the Buddha gave during his life. And specifically, each turning of the wheel of Dharma relates specifically to what the Buddha taught about the nature of reality. So there are some different types of teachings he gave on the nature of reality. And the Buddha lived to be 80. And then in what some people consider to be the ultimate teaching on impermanence, he left this physical life. We say that he passed at that point into parinirvana, or a complete liberation from suffering. And it's interesting. We'll get into that a little bit in a later class, but, you know, the impermanence is a really important part of Buddhist teachings. Recognizing that things are impermanent, that things are constantly changing, that we're constantly changing, that nothing continues to exist exactly the way it exists in this moment. Including the Buddha. You know, the Buddha died like everybody else does, basically left behind his physical form like everyone else does. So the Buddha's teachings were originally preserved and transmitted orally, and then they were written down later, a few hundred years after his lifetime. And the Buddhism originally spread in India, and then it spread into Sri Lanka and throughout Asia, into Japan, Southeast Asia, Thailand, China. And Buddhism actually spread into Tibet at a relatively later date from India. So different schools of Buddhism developed as it spread into different countries. There are actually four main schools of Tibetan Buddhism. We're part of the Gelupa school, or the Gelupa tradition of Tibetan Buddhism. And there are three other schools. And it can be kind of interesting to see how Buddhism kind of adapted or integrated the culture and traditions of different countries that it spread to, while the core teachings remain the same. So if you were to study a different type of Buddhism, like Zen Buddhism or Pure Land Buddhism, you'd probably find that some of the practices and some of the core teachings are the same as what we talk about here. Tibetan Buddhism tends to be a relatively kind of academic form of Buddhism, so a lot of emphasis is placed on studying. Monks will memorize texts and will be able to quote from memory from those texts. It's interesting if you come here on a Sunday and watch Geshe Gelug, our resident teacher, when he's explaining something. If you pay attention, you'll see that he's actually recalling passages from texts in Tibetan or Sanskrit, translating them into English, explaining them in English, and then explaining them to us. So that's one of these things that monks can do, some of the monks can do, is actually recall passages just from memory. And they memorize extensive collections of texts. And also, Tibet tends to be, it's a very high plateau, tends to be a kind of a very dry, not very colorful place. So Tibetans really like bright colors, which is why you see the colorful prayer flags and a lot of really colorful art that's part of this tradition. Yes? There's Gelupa, so there's Sakyu, Nyingma, Kagyu, and Gelug are the four schools. Sakyu, Nyingma, Kagyu, and Gelug. It's always exciting when I remember all four that quickly. And yet, what's that?
I'm not.
You're not excited?
No, I mean, I'm not going to remember those.
Oh, well, you don't have to. That's okay. Eventually, you might. You'd be surprised. There won't be a test. There are no tests, no pop quizzes, so if you don't remember them, don't worry about it. Okay, so a number of Indian masters had a very great influence on Tibetan tradition and in Buddhism in general. So we study certain texts and commentaries that were written by different Indian masters. And actually, if you look at the altar, you see these orange kind of square boxes all up and up the sides and around the top of the altar. So those are actually kind of what you could call the Buddhist scriptures or Buddhist different texts that we study. They include the teachings of the Buddha and also these commentaries on the teachings of the Buddha. And we do spend a lot of time in this tradition studying some of the commentary, a lot of the commentaries written by Tibetan scholars and Indian masters, because they expanded and kind of expanded and helped explain some of the Buddha's original teachings. So we spend time studying both. So we talk about what we call the three vehicles in Buddhism, the Mahayana, Hinayana, and Vajrayana. So yana is a Sanskrit term and literally means vehicle. Hinayana literally means lesser vehicle. It's often translated as the individual vehicle. So the Hinayana teachings focus specifically on individual liberation, on how a practitioner can liberate themselves from suffering. Mahayana is literally greater vehicle, but it's often translated as universal vehicle. And in the Mahayana tradition, the focus is on becoming enlightened for the benefit of all sentient beings. So still focusing on individual liberation, liberating yourself, but doing it with the motivation or for the purpose of being able to liberate all of their sentient beings and help them end their sufferings. So all Tibetan schools, as we said, are Mahayana. And the Hinayana split into 18 different schools not long after Shakyamuni Buddha's death. The Theravada school is the dominant Hinayana school today. And that's prevalent in Thailand, Sri Lanka, and Burma. And there are a number of Theravadan centers in the U.S. as well. So it's important to remember that the distinction between Hinayana and Mahayana isn't a rigid distinction. It's definitely not a matter of one way being better than the other. That's why a lot of people prefer to use the terms universal vehicle and individual vehicle rather than greater vehicle and lesser vehicle. It can become really easy to start thinking in terms of one group's teachings being better or one group's teachers being better. But they're just different focus. The teachings have a different focus. And there's certainly a lot of overlap. We talk about in Tibetan Buddhism specifically about the three scopes of practice. So the scopes focus on people, include people who are focused on individual liberation and also people who are focused on becoming enlightened so that they can benefit others. And it's not necessarily like you focus on one thing or the other exclusively. They're basically a way of categorizing the different teachings and the different types of teachings into these different categories or major the, what we call the vehicles. So Vajrayana refers to the tantric path, which is a very focused set of teachings and practices. So Vajra is a Sanskrit word, Tibetan words Dorje, and it refers to a little like a ritual object, little thunderbolt shaped object that people use in different ritual practices. And that represents what we call the diamond heart or indestructible nature of wisdom and compassion that we say are necessary in order to reach enlightenment. So those are, if you hear the three vehicles. And some of the stuff that we're going to talk about, you know, you could spend months and months just studying one of these topics. So part of what we're doing is just kind of introducing some of these topics so that you, when you hear them again, you have just a little bit of an introduction to them. So any questions about the history of Buddhism?
I have one.
Yes.
You mentioned Buddha's enlightenment, but you also mentioned monks. What's the difference between monks and Buddha?
The difference, the question is, what's the difference between a monk and a Buddha? So a monk is a person who has become ordained in this tradition and has taken on certain vows, what we call pratamoksha vows. So you'll see monks wear robes. They shave their heads. They tend to take vows where they give up some of the things that we enjoy, some of the things that we find desirable. And so that's specifically what a monk is, someone who's accepted those vows, has taken ordination, similar to what a monk in other traditions. A Buddha is someone who has actually achieved enlightenment, so who is completed this process or accomplished this process of eliminating all negative states of mind, all non-virtuous states of mind, and fully developing all virtuous states of mind. So someone could certainly be a monk and not be a Buddha, not be enlightened.
And they could be a Buddha and not be a monk.
Possible to be a Buddha and never be a monk, certainly possible. The Buddha taught that the monastic path, becoming a monk, the Buddha recommended that because basically you're just freeing yourself from a lot of the distractions that get in the way of your practice. And that's kind of the way we look at the monastic tradition in this, in Tibetan Buddhism. It's not that monks are like better people than everyone else or anything like that. They're just people who've made that choice to get rid of a lot of the distractions that take up the rest, most of our time. And they're dedicated their lives to studying Buddhism, to studying the Dharma. Does that answer your question? Okay. Any other questions? Okay. So we're going to talk a little bit more about meditation. In Tibetan, the word for meditation is gom, which signifies familiarization. So the idea is to familiarize your mind with something virtuous. That's the goal of meditation in Tibetan Buddhism. And it's not always the way we think about meditation. I mean, how many people here have done some type of meditation before this class? Okay, a few. Probably, I would imagine everybody else is at least somewhat familiar with meditation, have heard about it a little bit and what it is. And we kind of sometimes have different ideas about meditation, whether you've done some before, practiced in different tradition, whether you've maybe just heard about it or read about it a little bit. You know, people might think it involves some really elaborate visualizations or maybe just sitting and spacing out and relaxing. But, you know, we do have a specific definition of it in this tradition, and specifically it refers to the process of familiarization, familiarizing your mind, and specifically familiarizing your mind with something virtuous. There are a lot of things we familiarize our mind with, like television and chocolate and becoming angry, but not all of those things are necessarily considered virtuous. So there are different kinds of meditation in Tibetan Buddhism. There are two specific types of meditation that we talk about. One is focus or concentration meditation, and that's kind of the meditation that we've done so far. Basically falls into that category. The idea is just, and the meditation we're going to do here in a moment, falls into this category of a focus or concentration meditation, where the idea is just to develop your ability to concentrate on one single object, your ability to focus on and maintain your focus on one single object. And then there's also analytical meditations where you'll take a certain topic, maybe a topic you've been studying, and actually focus on that topic. And it can almost be like getting in a debate with yourself about it, where you explore certain aspects of this topic and question what it's about. And the goal in that is try to develop actual realizations where you actually get a more in-depth understanding or an in-depth experience of that actual topic. You'll find in this tradition we do have meditations that involve very elaborate visualizations and reciting mantras, but some of the meditations are really, really simple, like the one we're going to do next. Simple ones are still considered very, very powerful. You could spend a very, very long time just practicing these simple meditations and continue to get a lot out of them the more you do them. And if you have practiced meditation in the past, then, you know, what we do here and the way we do things here, the specific way we do things might be a little different, and that's fine. Again, it's not a matter of looking at one way as better than the other. It's basically just different ways of doing things. So we definitely encourage you to try the different types of meditations that we practice here. You may find one that really works well for you and that you may want to continue practicing. Or you may find that maybe some other stuff you've done in the past works better for you, and that's totally fine. You know, again, all we're trying to do here is just present information. One of the things they do recommend is that you focus specifically on one type of meditation. So rather than kind of mixing and matching, so if we're doing a specific type of meditation, like scanning the body, like we did, like what we just did, try to avoid like bringing in other elements from other meditations that you've done. Just try to focus on one at a time, and then if you like the other ones better, like we said, you can go back to those. So what we're going to do now is a meditation called Counting the Breaths. And I mentioned last week that if you go to our website, kadampa-center.org, you go to Spiritual Program and then Buddhism in a Nutshell, and you can download a handout that actually has a written description of all these meditations that we do if you want to try them on your own and get a reminder. So, sit comfortably again, whatever posture works for you. Whatever you're more comfortable doing. Sitting on a cushion, sitting on a chair, either way. The idea is just to be comfortable so you can focus on the meditation and not be too distracted by your body. So focus your attention on your breathing. And breathe naturally. Allow your mind to settle and become calm and present, ready to engage in meditation. We'll take a moment again to create an altruistic meditation, altruistic motivation. An altruistic motivation for this meditation session specifically. Think that you're meditating not just for your own individual benefit, but you're taking the time now to meditate and develop your mind to become a wiser and kinder person, able to benefit all beings. So focus your attention at the opening of your nostrils. Pay attention to the very subtle sensations as you breathe in and out through your nose. You can feel certain sensations as the air passes, as the small hairs move. Cooler sensations as you inhale, and warmer as you exhale. Don't follow the air into your body or out into the surrounding environment. Place your attention on the sensations associated with the breath right at the opening of your nostrils. Your job is to keep your attention firmly placed on those sensations only. As you inhale and exhale, mentally count each inhalation and exhalation together as one. Count from 1 to 10, concentrating on those sensations. If you become distracted, if the mind wanders to other things and moves away from the point of concentration, gently, without any further discussion with yourself about it, return your attention to the breath, rest your attention back on your breath, and begin again at one. Even if you never get past two, it's not a problem. The point is to train your mind to focus on one point only. This can take some practice to attain. If you reach 10, count backwards from 10 to 1, or just begin again at 1. Take a moment to dedicate any positive energy and insights from that meditation to the well-being and happiness of all sentient beings. So how'd that feel? Any comments? Good? Thumbs up? Good. Excellent. That's always a good reaction after you're done meditating. Anyone find themselves getting distracted easily? Yeah. It's really important to remember that distractions are completely normal. I mean, you could almost look at them as part of the exercise. And a really important part is when you notice yourself getting distracted, and distractions could be internal, very typical, you know, you're sitting there just focusing on your breath and counting your breaths, and one and two, and then before you realize it, you're off thinking about your grocery list or an email you're going to send or anything. And then, you know, it's very easy to beat yourself up about it and say, oh, why can't I do this right? You know, I'm a terrible meditator. I'm never going to learn how to meditate. And then you're just adding on to the distractions that have already, you know, been created. So very important when you notice yourself getting distracted, then just gently, without any further discussion about the distraction, no more conversation with yourself about it, just bring your attention back to your breath, rest your attention back on your breath, and begin again at 1. And you may only get to 2, or 3, or 1, or, you know, however far you get. The practice itself is to bring your attention back to the breath.
This practice seems really easy, but it's really profound.
Mm-hmm.
I did this practice for 3 years in Japan in the Zen monastery, and wow. What I thought was so very difficult at the beginning to keep my mind on my breath without my mind wandering, eventually, and not after a very long time, it began to stay.
Mm-hmm.
And the meditation deepened and deepened. It got better and better. And I was very, very pleased by the things I learned doing that, this particular meditation style.
Mm-hmm.
It was very rewarding.
Yeah, you can be very surprised at just what a simple meditation, and surprised at how quickly you might see yourself improve if you do it consistently. To really see improvement, you know, if you can get into a daily practice, you'll hear people again and again recommend that. And after a while, you do start noticing improvements. One of the things you might find along the way is it feels like you're getting worse. People say that all the time. It feels like they're getting worse initially. And what's really happening is you're just noticing a little more how distracted your mind tends to be. But then you continue practicing, and your ability to concentrate does get much better.
You will know when you go home and your mother says, "What are you doing? You seem different." She notices the change, even though you don't notice it.
So as we mentioned last week, Buddhism is all about the mind. And we had a question about the mind and, you know, what is it, right? How does Buddhism define it? So a number of different words for mind in Tibetan. In English, when we talk about the Buddhist concept of mind, we often use mind and consciousness interchangeably. So one thing that's important to remember as we talk about the mind in Buddhism is the mind is not the brain. So that's one of the first kind of defining concepts that we have. We say that the brain is physical and that the mind is non-physical. So we say the mind is shapeless, formless, and colorless. You're not going to be able to look on an X-ray or a CAT scan or anywhere and actually see what you experience as consciousness or mind. And there's certainly a relationship between the brain and the mind, between the physical and the non-physical. But it's just important to remember when we talk about it in Buddhism, we're not talking about them as synonymous. Whereas, for example, some people who are looking at a scientific definition of the mind, Western scientific definition of the mind, might see it as synonymous with the brain, just the activity of the brain. We say that they're two different things. The physical brain, the physical activity, and the mind are two separate things. So we say mind has two qualities, clearness and awareness. So it's defined as clear and knowing, and the function of the mind is to know. So that's another very basic aspect of the definition. Which might seem kind of strange to talk about the mind as clear and knowing, because we think of our minds, often as being very cluttered, you know, not necessarily this clear, luminous, knowing entity. But in Buddhism, we look at the clutter as obscurations, not as part of the mind itself. So we make a very clear distinction between mind and between this clutter or these obscurations that we experience, these non-virtuous states of mind. And an analogy I think I mentioned last week was the analogy to a mirror, or kind of a nice one to visualize is a lake. Picture a perfectly flat, calm, clear lake, beautiful lake. And that lake will actually reflect everything around it. So it reflects trees, it reflects the sky, it reflects clouds. But those reflections, they're there, but they're not actually part of the lake itself. They're separate from the lake. So these thoughts that we have, that we experience, are reflected by the mind. The thoughts are there, but they're not actually part of they're not actually the mind itself or what the mind is. And when we start talking about, specifically about the obscurations that we experience, about non-virtuous states of mind, a really great analogy is that you'll hear people use again and again is looking like a glass of water. So the glass of water could have a bunch of dirt in it, just this, you know, yucky, muddy, brown glass of water. But that dirt that's in there is not actually part of the water itself. It's not the H2O that makes up the water. And so with the proper instruments, with the proper methods, you could completely filter out and remove that dirt and just leave behind the pure, clear water. So when we're talking about mind, about consciousness in Buddhism, that's what we're talking about, that pure clarity, the clear stuff, just like the water in the glass. All the other stuff are just what's in the water, mixed up with it. So, and we can get back to that clear nature. It's one of the reasons why we meditate, is to connect more closely. It takes time, takes effort, but to connect more closely with that clear nature of mind. And you know, you'll hear about people talk about very advanced meditators, people who've been practicing for a very, very, very long time, intensely practicing meditation, who are very connected with this more clear nature of mind. So we say that the mind doesn't possess awareness. We say that the mind is awareness. And so we talk about six specific types of awareness. And five types of awareness relate to what we normally consider the five senses: sight, smell, hearing, taste, and touch. So we say we would talk about sight awareness, taste awareness, touch awareness. And then also to that we add consciousness, mental awareness. And so this gets into kind of an interesting discussion about the way the mind works and description of how we experience things. So those sensory awarenesses, we say, are kind of pretty dumb, you know, one way you could describe it, or very mechanical. So sight awareness basically is just perceiving shape and color, just perceiving form. Ear awareness is just perceiving sound, changes in frequency and volume. And so we experience these things like sight, like seeing something, seeing the shape of something, seeing the color of something. And then that becomes mental awareness as we think about it, as we cognize it or conceptualize it. That becomes part of the mental awareness. Yeah, we have a question. Can we start using the mic again? Yeah, if you have a question or comment, either one.
I was going to ask about how you said the mind is, and the mind in the terms of Buddhism is not a physical thing.
Mm-hmm.
If that's correct, then sight, sound, and all these physical sensations that we have are also non-physical. Is that a reference to the reflection on the lake?
So they're very similar explanations, and I'm going to tell you right away, I'm not by any means an expert in the Buddhist view of the mind and the actual, when you start getting into the actual nuts and bolts of how it works, you definitely, you know, want to talk to somebody who's more experienced, one of the more experienced teachers here. But as far as the basic definitions, what we do talk about are things that we experience, like our experience of sight, of sound, of taste, of our thoughts, as those reflections, separate experiences, not part of the mind itself. So, you know, one thing you'll hear all the time is people say, you are not your thoughts. You know, one of the things that happens when we meditate is we have these thoughts and we just think that's our mind, right? This constant stream of thoughts that we're experiencing. And then when you start to meditate, you start to actually improve your ability to kind of let that thought pass away and not be carried away by it. You know, not start telling a whole story about it. So in the same way, our experiences, the sight, the sound, the touch, those are concepts. Those are experiences, but not actually the mind. Those are not actually the mind itself. Does that help? Does that help answer your question a little?
Sure.
Okay, good. And again, this is just the Buddhist definition of things. You know, you will find other belief systems, other philosophies, or that are explanations that are different. So based on this cognization, this concept, conceptualization of what we experience. So you see something, you see this chocolate cake sitting on the counter, and all your eye does is recognize the shape, the color, the form of this chocolate cake. And then your mental consciousness, your mental awareness develops a concept of what it is. And based on that concept, then we have a reaction to it, or we begin to have a reaction to it. We're attracted to it, or we feel aversion to it, or we just have a neutral reaction. We move towards it, we move away from it, or we're just neutral. And a very fundamental concept in Buddhism is that the mind is always changing. It's continually changing. And just as important, or even more important, is we can change it. We can change our minds. We have the power to change our minds. So there's a growing awareness of this in our culture, I think. It's very interesting to look at modern scientific research, especially about things like neuroplasticity. We certainly still have some very traditional views, maybe consciously or unconsciously, about our minds being very fixed or very set. We're kind of set the way we are, you know? So this is something that we look at in Buddhism, something that we examine. Like I mentioned last week, Buddhism isn't about just kind of hearing things and accepting them on faith and say, okay, well, that's what the Buddha said or that's what this teacher said, so we have to believe it. It's about really examining these concepts and exploring them and analyzing them. And this is one of the things we analyze is, you know, is your mind set? Are you kind of stuck with what you have, the state of your mind or the things that you experience? So are we the products of our parents or our upbringing? Are we the products of our genes? Are certain things about us predetermined? You know, these are kind of all things that we explore. Are these things an inherent part of who we are? But what you find in Buddhism is a firm belief in our ability to improve our minds. That's a really key central concept. Buddhism is about the mind, and there's a very firm belief in our ability to change our minds for the better, to improve our minds. We're not just stuck with what we have today. It's not necessarily easy, but it's possible. Any questions about that? Comments? Yes, sir. Thanks.
So is that why removing all non-virtuous states of mind is so important? That's kind of like white noise, that in order to have your mind realize its full potential, you have to take away that white noise?
Yeah, white noise is a good analogy, I think. You know, it's like listening to a radio and hearing a lot of static, right? You can't really hear the music if it's staticky, so you have to tune that station in. I don't know if anybody does that. That's sort of good. Nobody has those radios anymore that you actually tune. Showing my age here. but, yeah, I think that's a good analogy. You know, you want to get rid of the static and be able to just hear the clear music. In the same way that that we're trying to clear the static, the white noise out of our minds, the obscurations out of our minds, to get to their full potential.
Okay, so I have a question.
Yes.
So being aware and this mental clarity and mental awareness that you're speaking of, I'm trying to figure out how to word this. Have you ever met like some people that seem to have like this calm about them? Like they mm-hmm. seem to be one of these maybe really aware people,
mm-hmm.
but like socially they're not really aware. So where does that kind of awareness fit in? Like, okay, so you're aware of your own thoughts and mental attitude or whatever, but on some level you have to be aware of kind of how you are being perceived, I guess. Like, how does that fit in? Do you understand what I'm saying? I'm not wording it correctly.
What's the purpose of being aware of how you're perceived? What's the goal?
To not offend anyone or be rude to someone.
Okay.
So, like, you may be in your own little blissful world
mm-hmm.
and be zen and floaty and happy, but maybe it's not, like, maybe it's not being perceived that way to other people, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, a couple ways we might talk about that here. One is that, you know, depending on what your goal is, you're probably still going to have to, most of us are still going to have to engage with the world in a useful way, right? So you could be very, very focused on your own practice, to the point where you're just walking around everywhere, not even wanting to talk to anybody, you know, just focusing on, but maybe that's not beneficial. You know, you could certainly get so involved in so Geshe Gelug, our teacher, he gives a great example of, you know, you're sitting there meditating, trying to be more patient and more caring towards other people and trying to develop these positive states of mind. And then, you know, you're, kids or your partner or whoever are in the other room in the kitchen making breakfast, making some noise, and you're sitting there, and after a couple of minutes you just get really irritated and start yelling at them, you know, excuse me, I'm trying to meditate in here, you know. So is that really beneficial? You know, are you really, what's your goal, what's your purpose, and are you really achieving that? But, you know, there also could, what we also, you know, talk about are people, there could be someone who's very, very advanced, you know, this person that you meet who doesn't seem to have much social skills, and maybe they're very rude, or maybe they say things that are inappropriate, or maybe they just don't seem to be very engaged with people. For all you know, that could be a Buddha who's there to teach you something, to help give you an opportunity to practice patience. So for ourselves, we try to develop ourselves in a way that we're able to be as beneficial as we can to others. And if others are not seeming to act in a way that's beneficial to us, then we just try to be patient with that. That's an opportunity to practice patience. Anything else? Any other comments? Questions? Okay. So we talked about the Four Noble Truths last time. Does anybody remember anything about the Four Noble Truths? Does anybody remember the first of the Four Noble Truths? Yes.
There was a lot of suffering involved,
yes. And the first noble truth is the truth of suffering. Basically, this just says, admit there's a problem, right? We don't like to admit that there is a lot of suffering in our lives. We like to distract ourselves from it or hide from it, avoid thinking about it. But what we say in Buddhism is suffering is inevitable. You know, even if you have a really great life, which probably a lot of people in this room do when you think about it, you know, we have food, we have shelter, we have transportation, we have clothes. You know, we don't have to struggle for some of the basic necessities the way a lot of people in the world do. And maybe you have a very happy, you know, comfortable life, you're very contented with your life. But still, all of us are going to face the inevitability of sickness, of old age, of death, of loss. I mean, these are things that we're going to have to face sooner or later. Our own experience of them and our loved ones experiencing those things too. And if you think about it, maybe we see examples of how our eagerness to avoid suffering maybe makes suffering more difficult to deal with when we do experience it. I don't know if anybody's ever thought about that or, you know, it's not something we always talk about. Certainly, you know, I mean, one example is where we live in a culture that's obsessed with youth, right? And everything, you know, no matter what age you are, somebody's going to try to sell you something that's going to make you look younger and feel younger, right? That's, you know, marketing 101. And if you think about it, we spend all this time trying to change ourselves maybe into something that we're not or aspiring to be something that we're not. And then as we do have to face, you know, inevitable changes, they can become more difficult to deal with, the more inevitable they become. And so one of the things we talk about in Buddhism is just admit it, admit the reality, you know, admit the fact that we do face suffering. Confront it head on. That's really what we're doing in Buddhism, not burying our heads in the sand, not just distracting ourselves from it. So one of the things we do is, and again, the analogy that we have is to a doctor who's going to try to cure an illness. We say the Buddha is like a doctor. And so the first step in getting better is admit there's a problem. You have to admit you're sick. So that's why we get very, very specific about suffering. You know, it would be really miserable and really unhappy if there was nothing we could do about it. But the idea in Buddhism is there is something that we can do about it. But you have to actually identify what the problem is first before you can cure it. You know, if you go to the doctor for pain in your knee, and he gives you, you know, because, you know, of an injury maybe, you go and injure yourself jogging, and now your knee hurts, and he gives you a bunch of antibiotics, it's not really going to help, right? You have to identify what really is the problem, what's causing it, what's the effective way of treating it. So when we talk about suffering in Buddhism, we get really specific about different types of suffering. So we talk about the suffering of pain or the suffering of suffering, which is basically what most of us recognize as suffering. Everyday aches and pains, you know, physical suffering, mental suffering. Basically what the first type of suffering is if, you know, as I hand everybody a piece of paper and say, okay, write down different types of suffering that we experience, the most common things that people would write down, that's the suffering of suffering. The knee ache, the toothache, things like that. And then they start getting more interesting from there. We have the suffering of change, which is basically the idea that everything we experience, because it changes, that causes us to experience suffering. And one of the examples that they give is like if you're at the beach, you know, and you're sitting on the beach, sitting on your blanket or sitting in your chair, and you start getting hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter. And so you decide to go and jump in the water to cool off. So when you first get in the water, it feels so good, right? Nice and cool and refreshing. And so that suffering of heat, diminishes and diminishes and diminishes. But as soon as you get in the water and start cooling down, what we say is there's a suffering of coldness that without even realizing it, you're starting to experience. We had a visiting teacher who was here a couple of weeks ago who has a great explanation for this. This is kind of the way he explains it, is that suffering of heat is diminishing as you get in the cool water, but the suffering of cold is starting to increase. And as long as the suffering of heat is diminishing and remains greater than the suffering of cold, and that suffering of cold hasn't increased too much, well, you still feel good about things. But there's a certain point where the suffering of hot has diminished enough and the suffering of cold increases enough that now you're cold. And you start to actually be aware of that suffering of coolness. And that increases, and then you have to get out of the water. So, you know, and this is kind of how we experience things without even realizing it, that a lot of the things we experience are actually in the nature of suffering for that very reason, just because they change. And what brings us pleasure at one point doesn't necessarily continue indefinitely to bring us pleasure. Another great example is chocolate cake. You know, that first bite of chocolate cake feels really wonderful, tastes really wonderful, gives you really wonderful feelings. But if you were to continue eating chocolate cake, one piece after another, probably by about the fifth or sixth piece of chocolate cake, it wouldn't be as wonderful anymore. Yeah, ugh, you get a lot of faces when you say that. So obviously, some things that we experience as pleasure, as happiness, we think, yeah, this is great, this is wonderful. But as you experience more and more and more and more of it, that happiness doesn't continue. It's not indefinite. It's not sustainable. So that's the suffering of change. And then we have all-pervasive suffering, which is a really, really juicy topic that we're not going to get too far into. But that is the third type of suffering that you'll hear people talk about. And this basically is suffering that we experience due to our very idea of reality or our very experience of reality and misconceptions we have about the way things exist. But that's a lot to get into tonight, so we'll just mention that. So suffering is sometimes referred to as dissatisfaction, that we're continually dissatisfied with things. Even when we experience things that bring us pleasure, we become dissatisfied with them. We have this always have this feeling that something's wrong. So those are some other ways that we talk about suffering in Buddhism. So, second noble truth, what's causing the problem? As we talked about earlier, our general default way of thinking about things, you know, sometimes without even realizing it, is we blame our suffering and give credit for our happiness on external circumstances, right? So I'm happy because this happened. I'm suffering because this happened. And I think we mentioned last week that, you know, it's interesting to start challenging this. So if this is the case, if our happiness and suffering is just the natural, inevitable consequence of the things that we experience, then why is it that we don't all experience things the exact same way? Why is it that people have dramatically different reactions to the same exact experience? You know, we talked about His Holiness the Dalai Lama and all the terrible things that have happened to the Tibetan people over you know, the past 50 years since the Chinese Communist government invaded Tibet. He every day hears, as the spiritual leader of Tibet, he's hearing countless stories about people suffering. It's illegal in Tibet to even own a photo of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. If we were in Tibet right now and the authorities came through the door, we'd all go to jail for having this photo up here. There's no freedom for them to practice their religious beliefs. And you could be arrested, imprisoned, tortured, killed. This happens all the time. And yet, His Holiness the Dalai Lama people who meet him will tell you he's a wonderfully happy person, a wonderful person to be around. Cheerful, happy, joking, totally compassionate. He views the Chinese authorities, the Chinese Communist government, as his greatest teachers because they're providing him such a great example to practice patience and practice kindness and love. Another great example, I think, is, you know, I lived in Florida for about 20 years. We experienced a lot of hurricanes down there. And it's interesting. I grew up in New Jersey. I have a lot of relatives up there. So, of course, with the big storm this fall, heard a lot about that. And it's really interesting when one of these storms comes through. You see the same thing out in the Midwest. Now, it's terrible, obviously a terrible thing, but some lessons you can learn from it. I remember watching on television, and the news would be out interviewing people after one of these storms came through. And you'd see someone, they're interviewing this person who's just completely distraught. I mean, it's almost painful to watch this person standing in front of their house, like on the verge of tears, just talking about how they've lost everything. All their photos, all their memories. I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know where I'm going to go. Everything's gone. And it's heart-wrenching to watch someone you know, when they're talking to this person. And then they'll go right down the street to another person whose house, again, is in ruins, completely destroyed. And that person's saying, you know, well, yeah, we lost everything, all the new furniture we bought last week and everything else. But you know what? Everybody's okay. You know, no one's hurt. All our neighbors are okay. We'll go stay in the shelter tonight, you know, whatever we have to do. It's only stuff. The important thing is everyone's okay. Totally different attitude. It's only stuff. It's only stuff. We can get more stuff, right? And then they'll interview, what really impresses me is they'll interview, you know, emergency personnel, police officer, firefighter, paramedic, and they're interviewing this person after the storm, and they're saying, yeah, you know, I haven't been to my house. I've been on duty since before the storm hit. I haven't been to my house. I heard my neighborhood got hit pretty hard, but, you know, I don't know what happened to my house, but right now my job is to take care of these people. That's my job, and that's what I'm going to do. I'm here for them. I'll go check my house out tomorrow when my shift's over. You know, no concern at all for their own situation, totally focused on helping other people. Just amazing generosity, amazing compassion, you know, genuine. You know, I'll worry about my stuff later. I have to help these people now. So completely different reactions to the same situation. And so obviously that starts to, you know, put some cracks in this idea that what we're experiencing when we experience these things, you know, when someone's angry at us, when the boss chews us out, when we don't get that promotion that we wanted, you know, our reactions to those things, maybe we have a lot more choice than we think, a lot more wiggle room. When good things happen, you know, certainly what the Buddha would say is that these things are, we are experiencing these things, and they do have a role in our happiness. There are certain conditions that we experience, but the happiness itself is something that's occurring in our own minds. And then, of course, when we see these people, the other interesting thing is we see these people reacting in such an altruistic way to these terrible conditions, right? You see the guy who's standing in front of the ruins of his house saying, yeah, it's just stuff. You know, everybody's okay. That's all that matters. You know, you see the paramedic saying, you know, I just have to do my job. I'll worry about my stuff later. And what do we always say? We say, well, you know, some people are just like that, right? I could never be that way. I can't imagine being that way. We're just awed and amazed that there are actually people in the world who think this way. And the way we look at things in Buddhism is that's also an extreme view. You know, the extreme view on the one side is that all these things are happening to us, that we have no control. The other extreme view is, well, yeah, you know, there are these things, happiness and suffering happening in our own minds, but we have no control over that either, that some people are just born that way, that I'm this way and that's the way I'm always going to be. So in Buddhism, we challenge both assumptions. We say that the mind is the cause of our happiness, or at least entertain that possibility, but the cause of our suffering, and that external conditions play a role, but they're not the cause. And that we actually have control, or maybe not immediately, maybe not today, maybe not right now, sitting here, we might not feel like we have a lot of control, but we have the ability to learn how to control our reactions. We have the ability, we can develop our ability, if we wish to do so, develop our ability to control how we react. And in Buddhism, we describe the causes of suffering as afflictive states of mind and negative actions, or what we call karma, that are arising from those states of mind. And we say that there are six root afflictions. And again, there's not going to be a quiz. There's not going to be, you know, any homework assignments or anything. We have to remember these things. But just mentioning some of these lists, there are a lot of numbered lists. You'll hear people say this all the time. There are a lot of numbered lists in Buddhism, in Tibetan Buddhism. And they actually are kind of a memory device to help you remember things. And it might seem in the beginning like there's all these lists and you know, how are you ever going to remember them? But if you become interested in this, you know, it actually does help you kind of remember what some of these concepts are. So one of those lists, the numbered lists, are the six root afflictions. These are the cause of our suffering, or the root delusions. And they're ignorance, anger, attachment, pride, doubt, and wrong views. So ignorance is not bliss. when we're talking about ignorance in Buddhism, we're talking about ignorance of the way things exist, a very fundamental ignorance that actually causes us to experience a lot of suffering. And this is something we're going to talk about a lot in the last class, go into more detail about it, very juicy topic. Anger, we can kind of see how that would cause suffering, I think. You know, you can just see when you're with somebody who's really, really angry that, you know, they're obviously not very in a very happy state of mind. Attachment. Attachment gets to be a really interesting topic, too, because we kind of think about attachment in a warm, fuzzy way in the West, I think. You know, we think about being attached to our pets and attached to, you know, our family members and attached to chocolate ice cream. Attachment has a very different meaning in Buddhism. It's more of a grasping, a clinging to these things. And what we say is it's fine to enjoy things, but the question is what happens when you don't get what you want? You know, what happens when you go home and you're just craving chocolate ice cream the whole way home, and then you open up the freezer when you get there and find that your roommate or your beloved partner or significant other has eaten all the ice cream and not left you any? You know, how are you going to react to that? So that kind of, no! So that kind of gives you a little idea of what attachment's all about. Doubt we define as indecision. So there's a productive doubt. You know, we talk about questioning a lot in this tradition. It's good to question things. Don't accept the first thing that you hear. Don't accept, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, if it's a very, very knowledgeable teacher, a very qualified teacher who is here explaining things to you. You don't have to just accept it. Question everything. But doubt is different. Doubt means, more specifically, we say failing to engage in what is productive or doubting our own ability to grow and improve. So that's a big one, doubting our own ability to grow and improve. That would be a cause of suffering. And then wrong views, so specifically having and the more you kind of understand some of the concepts we talk about, like next week we're going to get into some interesting concepts like karma, and having a specific incorrect view about what those things are, an actively wrong view, that would be also a cause of suffering. So the third noble truth, can the disease be cured? You know, the next question, we know, we've admitted there's a problem. We've looked at the causes of the problem, and then the next question is, can the problem be solved? And so the third noble truth is the truth of the cessation of suffering. And we say that yes, you know, the suffering that we experience can be cured, can be ended. So we like to, you know, view, if we say the causes of our suffering are internal, these afflictive states of mind that we experience, the question is, can we do anything about it? We like to say, you know, we like to view these states of mind as part of who we are. We say, I am an angry person. You know, I am impatient. We like to view these traits as an inherent part of who we are. But what we say in Buddhism, as we discussed before, is they're not an inherent part of our minds. They're separate from our minds, just like the reflection from the lake or just like the dirt in the water, and we can separate them. So by training our minds, we can learn to react differently to the external conditions that we experience. It's not easy, but it is possible. And what we say in this tradition is we can even reach a state of nirvana. You might hear this word, maybe heard this outside, you know, of here. You'll hear people talk about this here as well. What nirvana is a state of complete cessation of suffering and its causes. We're not talking about the band. We're not talking about the band. Nope. This predates the band. So it's important to realize nirvana, when we talk about it in Buddhism, is a mental state. It's not a place. It's a state of mind that you reach where you have ended the suffering that you experience, complete liberation from suffering. Yes.
So, suffering, are there different, I don't know how to put this, layers or states? So, like, you said chocolate ice cream's not in the fridge, so you get upset, but maybe that's secondary because you just lost your dog last week, or, you know what I mean? That's mm-hmm. really why you got upset about the ice cream, not because the ice cream not being there.
Yeah, that would be more of a conventional, you know, view of suffering. And certainly, Yeah, certainly there are things that we're not necessarily aware of, or that, you know, that are experience we have that trigger, you know, kind of suffering that we have buried. That's more of a conventional view of suffering. We do talk about layers of suffering in this tradition. Like, there's the suffering that you experience of not having the ice cream when you get home, but then we layer suffering on top of it, right? Of, you start thinking about, you know, that there are always people who, you know, okay, I have a roommate, right? So I go home, and I'm really dying to have some chocolate ice cream, and I open the freezer, and it's gone. So what do? Not only do I not have the ice cream, but then I start saying all kinds of unpleasant things about my roommate, and how he's always eating all the ice cream, and I never get any ice cream, and he could have left me at least a couple scoops, right? And we start making up this whole story about it and telling this whole story to ourselves, putting layers and layers of suffering on top of it. And then what happens? Roommate walks through the door with a bag full of ice cream and sprinkles and chocolate syrup, and, you know, he had the last scoop of ice cream, so he went out and bought more and extra stuff too, because he knows how much you like chocolate ice cream, right? So then when we talk about layers of suffering, that's more how we talk about it, about how we add to our suffering. But certainly what you're talking about, you know, on a conventional, yeah, that certainly happens all the time on a very conventional level. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yes.
The ignorance and the wrong knowing.
Mm-hmm.
So
ignorance specifically refers to not, the question is, ignorance and wrong views, do they refer to the same thing? Ignorance specifically refers to our lack of understanding about the way things actually exist. Wrong views is more of an active conception, not a lack of understanding, but an actively wrong conception, right?
Not to be aware.
Or choosing to actively have a conception that's not in line with reality. Right? So, you know, I might have no idea of what happened to the ice cream, right? That would be ignorance. If I started making up this whole story about how, you know, my significant other, my girlfriend, always eats all the ice cream and never leaves any for me, and she doesn't love me, and she must not care about me because she's always eating the ice cream, that would be a wrong view, right? When she's on her way back home with the big bucket of ice cream, right? Any other questions? Okay. The different kinds of suffering? The three types of suffering, like we talked about a moment ago? There's actually several different, yeah, numbered lists of different types of suffering. Yep. We are getting a little close to the end, so... we can perhaps talk about that next time a little bit, the other different types of suffering. But the three different types are, you know, and again, there are, it's like with a number of the different number of lists, there are actually different sets. There are a number of different ways of explaining some of these concepts. So we have the three categories of suffering, which is the suffering of suffering, suffering of change, and then the all-pervasive suffering. Then there are other numbered lists as well that go into more specific detail about it, which is what we're mentioning now. So just to kind of wrap things up, last couple concepts, I hate to go over too much, but in Tibetan Buddhism, so the fourth noble truth is, what is the cure? You know, so we're saying that this can be cured. So what actually is the cure? What do we need to do about it? What type of medicine do we need to take? So in Tibetan Buddhism, we have what's called the Lam Rim, which we mentioned before, which is the graduated path to enlightenment, step-by-step explanation of how to become enlightened. And so the teachings in different ways, a lot of the different teachings we have here, a lot of the different classes that we have are based on this Lam Rim, this graduated path to enlightenment that we look at in this tradition. And we say there are three principal aspects of the path. So this is kind of introducing what we're going to get into in the next few lessons, the three principal aspects of the path, which are renunciation, bodhicitta, and the wisdom of emptiness. And those are the main topics that we'll look at in the remaining three sessions. So I just kind of want to finish up with, and we'll probably get into, since we're running out of time a little bit, get into this more in the next lesson, but what it means to be a Buddhist. So we've kind of talked a little bit about some of the basic concepts, the life of Shakyamuni Buddha, the Buddhist view of the mind, a little bit of the history of Buddhism, and then the Four Noble Truths. So what does it actually mean to be a Buddhist? You know, how do you kind of apply all this? What we say is being a Buddhist doesn't mean memorizing texts or sitting on a cushion or the external manifestations of Buddhism. Certainly there are practices that go along with it. But actually being a Buddhist, one of the descriptions is being an internal being. So really looking inside yourself for the causes of happiness and suffering rather than always blaming external conditions. There is a ceremony, a formal ceremony for people who actually say they want to follow this path and I want to become a Buddhist. We call it a refuge ceremony, where you're taking refuge in the three jewels, which are the Buddha. So we have the historical Buddha and then also the enlightened mind that we're aspiring to reach, the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha, and then also the realization in the mind, the realizations in the mind of enlightened beings. And then the Sangha, which are the community of Buddhist practitioners, your fellow Buddhist practitioners. Also, we talk about the ultimate Sangha or the Arya Sangha, who are beings that are farther along than us on this path to enlightenment that we look to for inspiration. So those are the three jewels. And so when we say you take refuge in the three jewels, there's an external ceremony, but again, the real refuge is an internal process that you go through of accepting this as the path that you want to follow in your life. So we'll start back up with that again next week. Any quick questions? I kind of went over a little bit. I hate to do that. I know people maybe have places to go after this. But any quick questions before we wrap up? Okay. Thanks a lot for coming again. We'll just take a moment before we leave to dedicate the merits of being here. Dedicate any positive energy that we've created by taking the time to do these meditations and have these discussions. Dedicate that to our own well-being and to the well-being of other sentient beings, of all other sentient beings. All right. And we do have these books in, by the way, if anyone's interested. This is kind of the textbook for this course, Buddhism in a Nutshell. And as I mentioned last week, I think it has a CD, really great value. It has a CD in the back with all these classes taught by Venerable Amy Miller, who's really a wonderful Western nun. And it goes into a lot more detail. Some of the topics, as we mentioned, there are different ways of explaining things, more extensive lists than what we go through here in this class. And because this is divided into 5 2-hour sessions without any questions and discussion, just the lecture and meditations, we go into a lot more detail. The CD goes into a lot more detail than we actually do in this class. So if anybody's interested, those are available in the bookstore. Have a good night. Have a good week. Hopefully we'll see you all back here next week, next Tuesday. Thank you all for coming.